Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents For the Many, American Feminists and the Global Fight for Democratic Equality by Dorothy Sue Cobble. Narrated by Susan Erickson. For there can be neither freedom, peace, true democracy, or real development without justice. Mary McLeod Bethune, from her speech, Closed Doors, 1936. It takes all the brains that humanity can muster to operate a democracy. Mary Ritter Beard, Letter to Ethel Wood, August 9, 1950. Prologue, From Equal Rights to Full Rights. For the Many is a story of how women changed American politics and moved the United States and the world in a more egalitarian, social democratic direction. A politics for the many, not the few, predominated among politically active U.S. women for much of the 20th century. Understanding how they and their global allies created a more just and inclusive democracy changes the way we think about the past and future of American politics and Americans' relation to the world. Over the course of the last century and against great odds, the women profiled in For the Many articulated a transforming social vision, moved into positions of economic and political power at home and abroad, and enacted reforms of lasting value. For the Many tells the story of individual women, yet it is not a book celebrating individual heroism or the deeds of great women. It is what might be called a collective biography. Famous women, Jane Addams, Eleanor Roosevelt, and Frances Perkins, to name a few, graced this book and were indispensable to the intellectual and political revolutions of their day. But just as much attention is given to other women, many from less privileged backgrounds, who traveled alongside them. The courage, inventiveness, and stamina of women like Rose Schneiderman, Mary McLeod Bethune, Freda Miller, Maida Springer, Esther Peterson, and countless others propelled the struggle for democratic equality. This is a story of women, famous and not so famous, who acted together to change the world. I began my research thinking the egalitarian, social democratic traditions of American women, little understood and often underestimated, worthy of reconsideration. After more than a decade, I feel that way even more strongly. Today, much of what the women in For the Many believed and accomplished is under assault. Yet as writer Zadie Smith insisted in 2016, as she accepted a literary prize a few days after Donald Trump's election to the U.S. presidency, history is not erased by change, and the examples of the past still hold out new possibilities for all of us. The women at the heart of this book sought women's rights in a fairer, more democratic world. They were feminists because they believed women faced disadvantages as a sex, a perspective not widely shared in their day, and they sought to end those disadvantages. Yet they wanted more than equality between men and women. They wanted a world where all women and men could thrive. To capture their multi-stranded politics, I refer to them throughout the text as full rights or social democratic feminists. I adopt the modifier full rights, their phrase, to foreground their desire for the full array of rights and their belief that civil and political rights are intertwined with social and economic. Real equality, they judged, must be substantive, universal, and multidimensional. I place them in the social democratic tradition because they held fast to economic and political democracy, sought to curb the power of elites, and believed progress must be social. Yet full rights feminists and their social democratic politics turn up under different labels as For the Many moves through the 20th century. Socialist or progressive in the early decades, New Deal liberal or social democrat in the middle decades, and left liberal democrat or democratic socialist in the 1960s and after. Some labels persist, others drop by the wayside. I adopt these and other labels when appropriate, but not without trepidation. Our political labels, past and present, are frustratingly imprecise and change meaning over time. Nor do such labels adequately convey the complexity, contradictions, or dynamism of the politics of individual people or of the communities in which they lived and worked. But whatever their label, the central figures in For the Many shared a desire for a more egalitarian, democratic world, and they fashioned institutions, laws, and social policies in the United States and abroad to realize those aspirations. This is a book about women's politics, but it is not just about women. Men, too, advance the ideas recounted here, and at times proved indispensable allies. The women in For the Many organized alongside men in grassroots movements for democracy and social justice. They also joined with like-minded men in various political parties. Before the 1930s, full rights feminists could be found as often in the progressive, socialist, or Republican parties as in the Democratic. But after the transformation of the Democratic Party in the 1920s, a revolution led by women, they operated largely within the New Deal framework and saw the Democratic Party as the principal political vehicle carrying forward their broad egalitarian aspirations. From the 1930s to the 1970s, coterminous with the heyday of American social democracy, they pursued their aims in the elite governing spaces usually reserved for men, serving as cabinet officers, members of Congress, high-ranking diplomats, and delegates to intergovernmental assemblies. At the same time, they continued to bolster democratic labor and civic organizations outside of government, believing pressure from below kept states responsive to the majority. Full rights feminists were not always at home in male-dominated political realms or movements, nor were they always welcomed. Men were adversaries as well as allies. Women were denied political rights both before and after the enactment of the 19th Amendment prohibiting voting restrictions on the basis of sex. Equally frustrating, male-led parties and movements ignored women's voices, underplayed the disadvantages women faced as a sex, and mistook masculine norms and aspirations as universal. In response, female activists organized separately from men, even as they continued to participate in predominantly male organizations. They constructed women's committees, caucuses, and divisions inside grassroots movements and political parties. They established independent organizations and created all-female networks. This tradition of female political separatism was strongest in the early 20th century and re-emerged in the 1970s, but it never wholly disappeared. Women from different classes, cultures, religions, and racial groups participated in this female world, and a surprising number of immigrant and working-class women held positions of political and intellectual leadership in it. Still, some of the stiffest opposition faced by full rights feminists came from other women, including other feminists. Divisions among U.S. feminists intensified after the passage of the 19th Amendment, and for the next half century, American feminism split into warring camps. From the 1920s to the 1970s, full rights feminists joined with others in a social feminist coalition to oppose the National Woman's Party and its allies. Full rights feminists judged the National Woman's Party, with its unwavering single focus on equal rights or formal legal equality between the sexes, as narrow, individualistic, and elitist. In their view, the pursuit of women's rights in tandem with other broad social reforms was necessary for the majority of women to advance. Only by confronting multiple and intertwined injustices, they argued, could the problems of the many, men as well as women, be solved. The war between the two camps, symbolized by conflict over the Equal Rights Amendment, subsided in the 1970s, but U.S. feminism has continued into the 21st century as a contentious, multifaceted movement. Full rights feminists also battled with conservatives, men and women, feminists and non-feminists, on some of the great social and economic issues of the day. They clashed with conservatives over the desirability of social welfare and labor legislation, the role of the state in constraining corporate power and ensuring shared prosperity, and the rights due workers, immigrants, and people of color. Because they wanted greater democracy and more socialized markets, they disagreed with those who found authoritarian workplaces or unregulated cutthroat capitalism acceptable. They parted ways, too, with isolationists and go-it-alone nationalists, and not so amicably, over the extent and nature of America's responsibilities in the world, its relation to international institutions and alliances, and how best to achieve global stability and peace. At the same time, they took issue with those on the left who espoused revolutionary violence, or who, after the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, conflated socialism with Soviet-style communism. They rejected authoritarianism from the left and right, opposing the dictatorship of any person or class. They pursued egalitarian reforms through democratic means, popular education, the ballot box, democratic trade unionism, and legislative policy making. They chose nonviolent direct action, marches, strikes, sit-ins, and boycotts. Physical force was a last resort, and for some, never justified. Armed struggle and one-party rule, they believed, were weapons of the arrogant and the unimaginative. Better to change hearts and minds through moral suasion and democratic debate. For the Many is a global story. American politics has never been American-made. It sprang from the foreign-born and the native-born, from non-citizen and citizen, from those who visited the United States for days or stayed years, and from those who never set foot on U.S. soil. The world made America, as Eric Rauchway once put it, and to study American politics, one must see its borders as porous and its history affected by global ideas, peoples, and events. For the Many foregrounds the cross-class, multicultural, and multiracial character of social democratic women's movements inside the United States and sees activists outside it as crucial shapers of U.S. women's politics. Social democratic women forged alliances across geographical borders and built international institutions to move forward their reforms. They learned from women and men in other countries. They believed America's problems, could not be solved apart from the world. In writing this book, I followed the thread of U.S. women's social democratic politics over time and across place, surprised by where it led, heartened by what I found. I picked up the thread as it sprang into view in the years before the First World War. I held on as it crossed borders of nation and culture and into places I had only, and at times wrongly, imagined. I crisscrossed the globe, daunted by the difficulties of international travel and cross-cultural communication. I visited immaculately restored castles and overgrown empty fields, searching for where American full-rights feminists and their allies had gathered. I found traces in archival folders delivered by mistake, and in mislabeled boxes I opened as an afterthought. Some of my most important discoveries happened when I visited the wrong archive or took the wrong elevator to rooms rarely frequented. I found out more about the famous in the untouched letters of the obscure than from many days sorting through the voluminous, carefully arranged papers of the notable. I lived in countries not my own for long stretches, experiencing some of the fear, disorientation, loneliness, and exhilaration uprooting can bring. How much more intense were those feelings for the women in this book, American-born and otherwise, whose sojourns in nations not their own extended for years or lasted a lifetime. In the end, I returned home to an America much in need of the wisdoms of its social democratic foremothers. They, too, lived in a world of stark inequality and diminishing democracy. They, too, despaired at the cruelty of political tyrants and the selfishness of capitalist elites. And they, too, pondered the seemingly intractable hierarchies of race, nation, sex, and culture. Their solutions to these problems, though partial, bear revisiting. Today, few dispute the great chasm separating rich and poor nations. But it has taken longer to recognize the severity of economic inequality within nations, including within wealthy nations like the United States, where the maldistribution of income and wealth ranks among the worst in the world. The full rights feminists in For the Many made solving economic inequality a top priority, and to their credit, they sought a fairer distribution of the world's wealth both within and between nations. Diminishing the stark inequalities in U.S. society meant thinking seriously about America's role abroad and how its international policies affected others. U.S. prosperity rested on global prosperity, which in turn depended on flourishing economies in other nations and raising income and standards of life worldwide. Economic reform, they determined, could not happen without an intellectual revolution. Full rights feminists began their assault on economic inequality in the early 20th century by attacking the social Darwinist beliefs that justified it. Extreme inequality and mass poverty were not the inevitable result of hereditary differences between the poor and the rich, they insisted, nor were such problems the product of natural market laws, as conventional economic theories of the late 19th and early 20th centuries held. Economic stratification, as well as class and race hierarchies, were man-made, they proclaimed, and therefore could be unmade. The intellectual revolution they pushed forward enabled the social transformations of the 1930s and later. Today's resurgent social Darwinism, with its fictional gospel of unalterable market dynamics, ingrained racism, and class condescension, must again be dislodged if we are to move toward economic fairness and shared prosperity. Their proposals for lessening economic inequality varied as economic circumstances and political opportunities shifted over the course of the century. Yet some premises did not change. The U.S. economy could not be walled off from the world, and no single remedy would suffice. To tackle inequality at home and abroad, they pressed for a package of reforms. They called for the rights of workers to organize and bargain in the United States and other countries, regulation of domestic and global economies, higher international social and labor standards, and fairer, more democratic systems for determining the rules of state and workplace governance. They believed in the economic benefits of regulated trade and immigration. They defended workers' freedom of movement across borders and argued for the full rights of men and women of all races, religions, and nationalities. Poverty and oppression anywhere, they insisted, threatened living standards and freedoms everywhere. Ensuring democracy in all realms of society, in government, at work, at home, and in the community, loomed just as large in their politics as fixing the economy. They looked to states, intergovernmental bodies, and international organizations as crucial vehicles for economic and social reform, and demanded that they be democratized. Yet they never stopped encouraging organization from below. They sought democratic decision-making at work, and the freedoms, the right to vote, to free speech, to freely assemble, and to a free press, necessary for civil society to flourish. They created socially inclusive grassroots organizations within and across national boundaries to sustain democracy and promote the full representation of all people. At times, their democratic experiments languished, and authoritarianism gained the upper hand, claiming to be the better route to redistributing wealth and providing economic security. Yet the full rights feminists in For the Many refused to abandon democracy, as messy and frustrating as it was. They believed democratic states, if guided by and beholden to democratic labor and community organizations, could do much to ensure a fair share of wealth and power to the world's many. As fascism spread in the 1930s, the struggle for human rights took on added urgency among social reformers. Yet for many full rights feminists, defending the rights of all people, regardless of race, religion, nationality, or citizenship status, had always been a priority. For some, deeply held religious beliefs in the sanctity of each person motivated their human rights advocacy. Support for human rights flowed as well from secular beliefs in fairness and social justice and from personal, painful experiences of exclusion and persecution. From early in the 20th century, full rights feminists conceived of human rights broadly to encompass economic and social guarantees, as well as civil and political rights. And by mid-century, as women of color moved into positions of leadership in the movement, human rights came to mean ending the global color line and extending self-government to colonized peoples. None of the goals of full rights feminists, economic justice, democracy, or human rights could be achieved apart from education. Educating the mind and cultivating the spirit were not afterthoughts. Democratic workplaces and governments required an educated citizenry. A fairer world rested on expanding human capacities for compassion, empathy, and tolerance. Without that, politics, whether left, right, or center, could dehumanize and demean. Social democratic feminists pioneered urban settlement houses such as Chicago's Hull House, where rich and poor, native-born and immigrant, engaged in sustained cross-cultural learning. They also created emancipatory education programs for women workers in community centers, workplaces, and college campuses across the country. The most famous of these experiments in democratic pedagogy and social solidarity, the Bryn Mawr Summer School for Women Workers in Industry, lasted from 1921 to 1938. A multiracial group of participants from the 8-week residential Bryn Mawr School look back at us from the cover of For the Many. Taken after students voted in 1925, with the second Ku Klux Klan at its peak nationwide, to open the school to all women, the image evokes the school's egalitarian spirit and its dedication to resisting prejudice and hate. Bryn Mawr and the many other education programs encouraged by full rights feminists proved pivotal in fostering a liberatory, inclusive women's movement. To be sure, the women in For the Many did not always live up to the democratic and inclusive ideals they espoused, nor did their actions always have the desired effects. They could be ethnocentric and misguided, endorsing policies that sustained rather than dismantled inequalities. Power imbalances and hierarchical notions of nations and peoples affected their choices and at times blinded them to the needs and realities of others. How to reconcile the competing demands of near and far, of local and global, was hardly self-evident. Still, many rejected the dominant imperial, racist, and elitist presumptions of their day. Immigrant women and women of color tended to see peoples beyond U.S. borders not as them, but as us. Religious and moral values also nourished cosmopolitan proclivities and propelled many toward more egalitarian alliances. They traveled, they learned, they changed. They navigated differences within their own ranks over how to address the deep and abiding tensions of social class, religion, and race. They adopted ideas from those they admired and understood, as well as from those they underestimated and misunderstood. Mutually beneficial outcomes could and did occur. The story of U.S. women's social democratic politics over the last century was not one of ever upward progress. It moved in fits and starts, with tragic detours and dispiriting defeats alongside celebrations and gains. For the Many opens with the rise of U.S. women's organizing for political inclusion and economic justice in the early 20th century. A pivotal era for working women's politics at home and abroad. In the wake of World War I, U.S. full rights feminists deepened their transnational connections with labor and social democratic women outside the United States and won surprising victories on the global stage. Political advance slowed in the 1920s in the face of resurgent conservatism at home and thwarted alliances abroad. Yet, as American women remade the U.S. Democratic Party in the late 1920s and built dynamic, multiracial, left-leaning movements from below in the 1930s, democratic egalitarianism revived in the United States, even as much of the world slipped into authoritarianism. From the 1930s to the 1970s, social democratic feminists secured far-sighted and consequential reform. In an oft-repeated and troubling pattern, however, some of the policies closest to their heart especially those boosting social and economic guarantees, won more adherence abroad than at home. The late 20th century.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?